Good afternoon, everybody. Today I'm going to change tact a little bit and talk about something quite different from what's been spoken about so far today. And that's some work that we've been doing on the density functional triple jump, or what we call a density functional triple jump. And this is a way, a general framework really, of stepping from a low-level calculation, a cheap low-level calculation, up to a much higher one, with the aim of obtaining higher accuracy at a much lower cost. Okay, so just by way of motivation, we all know that DFT calculations are very popular. And why are they so popular? Well, they have a very attractive cost-performance ratio. We can get very good answers at a very low price. And this allows us to apply DFT to a wide range of chemically interesting topics. Now, what determines the cost and performance of a DFT calculation? Well, there are three key aspects. Firstly, obviously, the exchange correlation functional itself, the basis set that we use, and also the quadrature grid that is used in order to work out the integrals. Now, changing any of these quantities can improve the calculation. But what we find is that as we improve any one of these or all three of these quantities, the calculation can become quite expensive. And things are not really equal in the DFT world because you can wind up paying a lot extra for not much more. What do I mean by that? Well, these calculations can become very expensive, but the actual changes that we see in the density and the energy can actually be quite small. So what we'd like to investigate is the possibility of using some sort of perturbative approach in order to step up in our levels of theory, going from a low level to a high level. Okay, so these dual-level ideas are not new. Way back in 1977, Hutznagar and Hurau introduced the idea of using dual basis sets in calculations. Since then, other groups have also looked at the dual basis model, including King co-workers, and more recently, the group of Head Gordon has addressed this dual basis idea as well, in what they call the dual basis Hartree-Fock and dual basis DFT methods, which I'll come back to a bit later on. There's been far less work done on dual grid approaches. In fact, about the only reference we could find is one by Tozer and co-workers back in 1995, where they have a paper that describes their implementation of the Kohn-Sham density functional theory. And there they suggest the possibility of using a small grid for the SCF part of the calculation, and then right at the end using the target grid, the much larger target grid, and claim that this introduces very small errors. More recently, Nakajima and Hurau have introduced what they call their dual-level DFT, and this is the first example where we've looked at using different functionals, and they also they pair this up with a dual basis approach. So this is, if you like, a double jump kind of approach. So what are we doing? Well, we're really trying to combine all of these three ideas, changes in the basis, changes in the functional, and changes in the grid, into what we call this triple jump approach. But we also combine them with a more accurate method for jumping in the basis set direction. Okay, most of these dual basis methods use some sort of perturbation theory to step from the small basis to the large basis. We use a slightly different approach, which is more accurate and more slightly more expensive. Okay, so to get a picture of what we're trying to do here, we have the density functional perturbative corrections cube here. And each dimension of the cube represents one of our three quantities that we're interested in changing. Okay, so what we're going to be interested in doing is starting up in this top left-hand corner, which is what I'll call the primary level that we're going to use. This is going to be the low level, or the reference level of theory that we're going to use. And then we're going to want to be able to step in the different dimensions to go from the primary level up into our target secondary level. Okay. Now, we can either step in one dimension at a time, so just changing from the primary functional to the secondary functional, and this gives rise to what we call the dual functional approach. Alternatively, we just change the basis set, going from the primary to the secondary, and this is called the dual basis approach. And then finally, we have our third dimension, the grid dimension, where again we can leap from a small primary grid up into our large target grid. So these are what we call our single jump methods, and these are the ones that have primarily been targeted before us. But we can go a step further and consider changes in two of our dimensions at once. So for example, if we're interested in changing the functional and the basis, we wind up with our dual functional, dual basis approach. And this here is closely related to the work of Nakajima and Harrell. But we're going to introduce two other possibilities where we change the grid quantities as well, the dual functional dual grid and dual basis dual grid. So these are what we call our double jump methods. And finally, we can consider changes in all three quantities, where we're leaping from our primary level over here all the way down to our secondary functional, secondary basis, and secondary grid. And this, if you like, is a combination of all the approaches, hence the technicolored arrow. And this is what we call our density functional perturbative corrective scheme. And we can consider all the other double jumps and single jumps as being special cases of this triple jump across the diagonal. Okay, so the question naturally arises, we've got all these different methods, which ones are worthwhile and which ones are not? Which ones give the best bang for your buck, if you like? Okay, so that's the basic picture. Now we're going to look at what it is we're actually doing in a little bit more detail. We're going to start off by performing an SCF calculation in a primary, small primary functional, primary basis, and primary grid. We're going to converge that, and that converge calculation gives rise to our primary density. And we can use that primary density in one of two ways, which we call either type A or type B. Either we can take our density and then just do a new energy evaluation, but this time we're going to replace the functional with a secondary functional. And we're going to replace the grid with a secondary grid, so that'll give us a slightly improved energy that'll differ from our energy from the primary basis. If we take this type A approach, then we can't incorporate changes in the basis set. Or an alternative is if we use our primary density to build a new Fock matrix or Cohn-Sham matrix using the potential, the potentials from this primary density. Now, having built that Fock matrix or Cohn-Sham matrix, we can diagonalize that once, and this gives us a slightly perturbed density, slightly different density, an updated density, if you like, which we can then put into our energy evaluation machinery. Okay, so even more details. We start off with a primary calculation. We represent our primary density in terms of our mu nu basis, and the mu nu basis is our small reference basis. Now this density gives rise to the Coulomb and exchange potentials, exchange correlation potentials, as written here, where the exchange correlation potential arises from the particular exchange correlation functional that we're using at the primary level. Okay, so that's the primary calculation, all fairly straightforward. Here we come to the DFPC steps. Firstly, the Fock formation, Cohn-Sham matrix formation, which arises in the type B methods. Now here, this is a very general expression for the Fock matrix. Our primary density is incorporated here because it's we're using this Coulomb potential, and the primary density is going to give rise to an exchange correlation potential in here. But we now allow ourselves the freedom to change our basis set, so we're going from the mu nu basis set, the small basis set, up into a larger basis set, which I'll label AB. We're also allowing ourselves to change the exchange correlation functional that we're going to use, and therefore the potential. And of course, we can also change the grid. Okay, so this is a very general form for the Cohn-Sham matrix there. Once we've built the Cohn-Sham matrix and diagonalized it, we obtain a new density, our alter density rho tilde, which we then feed into our energy evaluation machine, if you like, which is given by this expression here. And again, we have the flexibility to choose what grid and what exchange correlation functional we use at this stage as well. A key thing to point out here is that we evaluate the energy using this expression here, which includes terms that are quadratic in the updated density matrix. I guess this is the updated density matrix corresponding to our rho tilde. Okay, so these quadratic contributions are different from what's been done in the past, and is one of the reasons why our method for jumping in the basis set direction is more accurate. Okay, so we can make a couple of observations about what we're doing here. As I've already pointed out, our energy contributions that are quadratic in rho tilde are included, and that's for greater accuracy. There's no separate projection step going from the primary basis to the secondary basis, and again, this differs from some of the past dual basis methods, where they actually need to project from the primary basis up into the larger secondary basis. Our projection, if you like, is through the Fock matrix formation. We don't place any restriction on the basis sets that we use, so we don't require that they be subsets or supersets. And again, the subset superset requirement is something which is necessary in some of the other dual basis methods. The reason they impose this constraint is because you can get some additional speed up benefit from having your primary basis as a proper subset of your secondary basis. However, because we're using a more accurate energy expression, we can actually use even smaller primary basis sets. And actually finding small basis sets that are subsets of a larger basis set is actually quite difficult. That is, small basis sets that are well balanced. So not having the subset superset requirement means we don't have to go and develop a whole bunch of new basis sets, which other groups have had to do in order to use their method. And just finally, our energy that we compute is variational, and again, that differs from the dual basis methods of the Head-Gordon group, for example. Okay, so let's see how well we do. Firstly, we're going to consider the question of accuracy, what sort of errors are introduced by the different jumps in the different directions. And in order to do this, we considered the 257 neutral molecules in the G3 data set. These are all fairly small molecules. We had a target secondary level of theory. So this is our large basis set, grid and functional. And we set that to something fairly popular, B3LIP 6311 plus G3DF2P. And this here is the quadrature grid, which is a Euler-Maclaurin-Lebedev grid, consisting of 75 radial points and 302 angular points. And a pruned version of this grid is used in some packages. I think it's the fine grid. Okay, so the numbers or the errors that I'm going to report are all in kilojoules per mole. And these are errors with respect to this target level of theory. Okay, so if we converge the secondary calculation, this is what we're aiming for. And the errors that we present here are going to be with respect to the secondary target. And the statistics that we have, we're going to look at the mean absolute error, the maximum error, and the number of outliers, where the number of outliers is defined as when the difference in, or the error, is greater than 4 kilojoules per mole. And this is around the level that's considered chemical accuracy by many people. Okay, so first off, let's look at our functional jump. So here are the summary statistics here, and what can we say? Well, first of all, here are the results for the primary calculation. So this is So the primary calculation was a BLIP 631G star using a, oh sorry, no, the, this is just in the functional direction. So our primary calculations are using either this functional written here, and we're using the basis set and grid written up there for the primary case. Okay, so what can we say? Well, we can see that the errors in the primary calculation are quite substantial. Remember, these are all errors in kilojoules per mole. what have we got? About an order of hundreds of kilojoules per mole on average. The LDA that we've used is considerably less accurate than both of the GGAs that we've considered here. Okay, so these numbers here really represent how much work is required for us to do by the jumping approach. Okay, this is the error that we're trying to jump over. And you can see that if we do a type B functional jump, and so this is where we form a new Cohn-Sham matrix, diagonalize it, and use that updated density, the error is reduced by about two orders of magnitude. And we're now looking at errors even for the LDA of less than the chemical accuracy. We still have quite a few outliers though, and for this reason we don't recommend that if you're jumping to a hybrid functional that you use an LDA. It seems clear that really GGAs do perform much better in producing much less error. And clearly there are no or very few outliers when we do that. Okay, so that's merely reiterating what I've just said there. SVWN introduces significantly more error. And the type A methods, which I haven't shown here, that's where we don't actually do another FOC formation. These are cheaper, but these are also an order of magnitude less accurate. Okay, so the functional jump, we're introducing errors of less than a kilojoule per mole. Let's look at the basis direction now, where again we've got a primary calculation which is made up from B3LIP with this grid, and now using, that should be basis there, sorry, using these basis sets. What can we say? Well, the errors are of the same order of magnitude really for the primary calculation, orders of hundreds of kilojoules per mole. So again, this represents how much work we need to do in the jumping scheme. And if we look at the type B approximation again, this is the only one that's available from the basis direction. We have to do a FOC formation. We can reduce these down to about a kilojoule per mole again, as long as we have D functions in our primary basis. Now the reason why we require D functions, I think, is that if we look at what the outliers are for these systems, they are dominated by hypervalent species, and hypervalent species obviously benefit from having the d orbitals floating around in the primary basis set. So this is a this is an important lesson here, that we can't make the primary level too cheap. We need to be able to model all the important characteristics of our systems. But if we do that, then we can see that we do get pretty good errors there. And as I've already mentioned, there's no type A analog for the basis direction. Okay, moving on to the jumping in the grid dimension. Here we've only considered one grid, and it's a pretty small grid, SG0. it has about 1,400 points per atom, so about 6%. Of the points for our target secondary grid, so much, much smaller. And we found that even with this very, very small grid, this is the smallest standard prune grid that we're aware of anyway. Even with this very small grid, we can see that the grid jump is introducing effectively zero error. Okay, this is well less than the errors associated with the basis jump and functional jump. Another thing to point out is that these are all type A methods. So this is the approach that Tozer actually suggested, where you just simply take the density and change your grid. And you can see that the errors introduced are very small. We can do a type B approach as well. I haven't shown the results here, but they are an order of magnitude more accurate again. But we deem that as being a bit of an overkill. And we just note that you could actually look at using even smaller grids than the SG0 grid. But we haven't done that yet. Okay, so they were all the single jump methods. Now we can move on to some double jumping. Again, we've got the same target level of theory. This is our secondary level of theory. But this time we're going to be changing two quantities at a time. So this first row here, we're changing the functional and the grid. So we're jumping up from a BLIP SG0 calculation up to this guy here, keeping the basis the same. Next line down here keeps the functional the same. And the last line keeps the grid the same. We've just got results for the type B method here. And as you can see, they're all pretty good. They're all around about a kilojoule per mole, or in the case of a dual functional, dual grid method, even smaller. Okay, so what this is telling us is we can jump in multiple directions without introducing too much additional error, which is great. Just worth pointing out that this dual functional, dual grid method is the most accurate of our double jumping approaches. Okay, so that by implication, the basis set is changes in basis set are introducing most of the error there. And finally, we can consider our triple jump, where now we're changing all three quantities. We've got a couple of different levels here. We've kept the basis set at our 631G star level. Remember, we needed those D functions to model the hypervalent species. And the grid, we deemed it not necessary to go any smaller than SG0. And we can see that we get very similar errors to the approaches that we had before, which didn't change the grid. Okay, so you can see that the effects of changing the grid, again, are microscopic. It's also worth pointing out that there are some non-additive effects in the errors. What do I mean by that? Well, if we look at this guy here, so this is a case where we've changed the, where we've kept the functional fixed at B3 lip. We see that the maximum error that we've got is 21 kilojoules per mole. But actually, if we change that functional, the maximum error goes down. So, yeah, just worth pointing out that there are some non-additive effects there. Okay, so just to give a visual impression of how the errors are changing, here we've plotted a histogram of our 257 systems. So this is the errors in the primary calculation as compared to the secondary calculation there. And we can see we have everything ranging up to thousands or 1,000 kilojoules per mole. If we then apply our triple jump method, so this is changing all of our quantities here, we've now dropped everything by two orders of magnitude, and we can see that most of the errors are located less than 2.5 kilojoules per mole. So what's that telling us? It's telling us that we can jump in all three of our directions without introducing a significant error, where significant is defined by this chemical accuracy. And here we've just labeled some of the outliers there, and you can see a few hypervalent systems in there causing us problems. Okay, so that's the accuracy question, but that's really only half the picture. We need to know what's best, the best bang for our buck, not just what's the most accurate method. And for this, we chose four systems: threonine, caffeine, guanine, cytosine, base pair, and porphine. There's a range of shapes and sizes there to do some more detailed timing analysis. So again, we chose our target secondary level to be B3 lip. 6311 plus G3DF2P with the same quadrature grid. So that's our secondary level we're aiming for. And from the results from the single jumping approaches, we chose the primary level of BLIP 631G star SG0. Again, the errors that we're going to show you are in kilojoules per mole with respect to this secondary level of theory here. I'm also going to show some timings, and these timings are expressed as fractions of the secondary calculation time. Okay, so we're aiming to get the energy of this guy here in less time, and so how much less time is going to be expressed as this fraction. Okay, so here are the results. a lot of numbers here. I'll guide you through the table though. So we've got all our different methods that we've proposed so far. So there are seven different methods corresponding to the different vertices on the DFPC cube. And then we've got our four systems labeled up here. Okay, so if we just zero in on some of the timings, what can we see? Well, the top three methods here are all the single jump methods. And what we can see is that the standout performer is obviously the dual basis approach. This is what gives us our greatest savings. And in fact, we can run the calculation in about a third of the time of the full secondary calculation. So we're seeing speed ups of about a factor of three. That's just changing the basis set. If we just change the functional, the speed ups are less impressive. We only see about a 20% speed up, which is similar to the speed ups that we see in the dual grid A approach as well. However, in the grid changing approach, we obviously introduce very little error. The dual basis approach introduces much more error. But if we had to pick one, I'd probably say that the dual basis is giving us some useful speed ups while still keeping a handle on the amount of error that is introduced in the four systems. Okay, so that's our single jumping approaches. Let's move quickly on to the double jump approaches, and again, just highlighting the timings that we have here. These are obviously a lot faster because we're introducing changes in two quantities. The dual functional dual grid approach has the least impressive speed up, so we're only saving about a factor of two in the cost of the calculation, but obviously here it's also the more accurate of the two of the three methods as well. But if we change the basis set either in a dual functional dual basis or dual basis dual grid approach, we can see that we're either getting speed ups of about a factor of three if we change the functional in a basis, or around three to four if we change the basis in the grid. And again, if we had to choose one, the dual basis dual grid approach gives us our best speed ups, and again introduces fairly modest errors. In fact, you can see the errors over and above the dual basis approach itself are very small, and again this just reflects the fact that the changes in the grid introduce very little error. And finally, our full density functional perturbative corrective method, which looks at changes in all three of our quantities. There's only one jump, obviously. We can see this is the cheapest of all of the methods, marginally cheaper than our best double jump method here, and introducing a little bit more error, because now we're jumping in all three dimensions. So we're seeing an error introduced by the functional jump going from this level to this level here. Okay, so what can we say? Well, if we look at our triple jumping approach, we can get to within chemical accuracy of the total energy for the secondary level of theory in about a quarter of the time. How does this compare to the dual basis DFT method? This was the one introduced by Head Gordon and co-workers. Well, they slightly outperform us from a timing perspective. They see speed ups of a factor of about five compared to our speed ups of about a factor of four. But this is where we really gain. Their errors are about twice as large. Okay, so we're trying to introduce these speed ups while still keeping a handle on the error that's introduced. And as you can see here, all of these errors are what we would consider outliers. These are beyond the chemical accuracy target. So what we've got here is a method which provides a different price performance level to the dual basis DFT method. And just finally, to conclude, what we've discussed here is a very general framework for doing dual level DFT calculations. So this is the DFPC cube, where we can vary all of our key quantities that go into a DFT calculation. The dual basis method that we employ includes contributions that are quadratic in the updated density matrix, and we do this so that we can retain accuracy. And if we do that, we can see that by triple jumping, we can see speedups about a factor of 4, with errors still below chemical accuracy. And if we want a little bit more accuracy, then we can consider the dual basis, dual grid method, double jump, which has a slightly increased cost, but gives us greater accuracy. And just finally, I'd like to acknowledge Jia Deng, a PhD student in our group, who has done many of the calculations that I've presented here. And thank you for your attention.
We have a very short time for some questions. Please, we have you. Can do without microphone.
How many iterations do you have typically in your target calculations?
How many iterations for the target calculations? Right. For the systems that the four systems that I showed there, I think there was about 7 to 9 SCF iterations.
I'm asking that because I'm wondering if on the top of a triple jump, if you using method B, if you did one more iteration, then at the target level, probably one would drop by order of magnitude.
What would
the extra cost of calculation would be very little, right?
So you're suggesting doing two Fockbert of two?
Doing just one construct of a Pontian matrix
at
the accurate level, at the target level.
Which is what we...
Just one extra iteration, right?
That's what we do, yeah?
No, it's not. No, you construct density. And then you stop. You construct density, you construct Pontian matrix, you generate energy, and that's it. But I'm saying do one more iteration then at the accurate level.
So you want to build the Fock matrix using the updated density?
Right.
Okay.
Just one iteration, the increase of the cost will be of the order of 1/10 of the total cost.
Practically
converge, I see.
It doesn't actually. You get most of the gain in the first Fock build. You won't see much improvement in accuracy if you do another iteration. However, you will see quite an increase in the cost of the calculation, because the cost of these calculations will be dominated by the expensive level of theory, so by the final iteration that you do. Sure.
Did you consider also energy differences?
We did, so for looking at reaction energies and things like that. I didn't present any results here. But we've considered these for a related method using the same idea in Hartree-Fock theory. And there we see very similar results, but obviously you do see the cancellation when you're looking at differences, and so you can get away with slightly cheaper levels of primary theory, for example.
Let us think again.